Ready to proceed?
Yes, Sean.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the court, William Fletcher on behalf of the appellants. This appeal raises two issues that deal with trial by jury. One of them involves whether or not post-trial additive can be applied without violating a party's right to trial by jury as protected by the Delaware Constitution. The second issue concerns whether or not the record in this case would permit the plaintiff to submit her negligence claims against defendant Daisy Construction Company to a jury at trial, rather than having them dismissed on summary judgment. This matter involved a motor vehicle collision that happened on November 5th of 1999. It was a multiple car collision. It happened on U.S. Route 13 near Woodside, Delaware, at a construction site that was being controlled and operated by defendant Daisy. The plaintiff, Michelle Reed's vehicle, was rear-ended as part of this multiple car collision by the vehicle operated by defendant Hint. The matter went to trial only against defendant Hint, as defendant Davey was dismissed before trial on a motion for summary judgment. After the first trial, the jury awarded zero damages. Plaintiff filed a motion for a new trial, which was granted, primarily upon this court's rulings in Alpha Metano versus Baker, which held that when there are objective findings of injury that are not disputed and the jury awards zero damages, that award is improper and cannot stand. Thereafter, a second trial was held in the year 2007. A second verdict for zero damages was returned, and the plaintiff moved for a new trial. At that time, the defendant again opposed the motion for a new trial, but also sought additor.
Now, isn't that unusual for a defendant to ask for additor?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it is. As a matter of fact, as the authority that we've cited to the court indicates, it almost we can find little or no evidence of it happening in Delaware. Additor has been traditionally used as a post-trial remedy by a plaintiff.
Do you believe that the parties agree that at the end of the second trial, when the trial judge considered the motion for a new trial and for additor and ruled as he did, that everyone agrees that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. I say that in a sense that not only was the same medical evidence presented, but there was actually additional medical evidence in support of the plaintiff's claims at the time of the second trial. And in his opinion, the trial judge specifically stated that he had already ruled that a zero verdict was improper, and he was not going to revisit that.
That's why I asked the question. In looking at his ruling, I'm trying to conclude by inference, because it's not specific, that he thought that the result of the second trial was also against the weight of the evidence. Otherwise, he wouldn't have considered the motion for a new trial or the additor, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. How did he come up with the conclusion that $2,500 was an – skipping the question about the defendant asking for the additor for a moment. What is the factual finding to support $2,500?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. We did not ask for additor. We did not present evidence as to what a minimum amount should be.
Okay, well, let's assume for the sake of my question that additor under these circumstances is appropriate. Somehow it's consistent with the philosophy behind post-trial relief, whether it's remittiture or additor. What, for us to review, we have to know the facts on which the trial judge relied in coming to the number of $2,500, should we believe that additor was appropriate. As I read his order, he speaks to a short period of time for pain and suffering, but nowhere in his order does he address any medical bills that were incurred during that period of time. And I can't put together in my mind $2,500 from where for what? Is it for pain and suffering? Is it for medical bills? Is it for a combination of the two? Where would I go to find that answer?
Your Honor, it's not in the lower court's opinion. The lower court opinion is very brief as to what the evidence was. I believe that the parties did outline in their post-trial motions, at least in a highlighted fashion, what some of the elements of damages were. There is evidence, for instance, that this lady had a permanent injury, and that's unrebutted. There is evidence of $7,000 of medical expenses, which were not rebutted. And there was a second doctor who found objective findings a year or so after the accident.
Well, didn't the trial, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Didn't the trial judge expressly refer to the $7,552.36 in medical bills and state, I am not persuaded that any of the $7,552.36 of expenses introduced into evidence are approximately related to the injuries which the plaintiff sustained in the accident. So we have at least that finding, don't we?
You do, Your Honor, but you don't have any evidence as to why the court rejected that evidence, which no doctor questioned. But that is what the court's opinion said.
So that it was not argued in the trial that these medicals were unrelated to the accident?
Not argued by a medical expert, doctor. The defendant presented no medical expert, and certainly none of the treating doctors said that their treatment expenses were inappropriate.
Well, as I read the trial judge's determination of $2,500, he says there was no more than a 10-week period during which he could tell from the evidence that she would be entitled to any damages. Because he doesn't specifically identify the medical bills that were incurred during that period of time, or even, as I read it, the 10-week period he's talking about, I can't figure out whether the $2,500 represents simply out-of-pocket specials or pain and suffering or some combination of both. What do we need to know in order to review that order? First, what's the basis for review? What's the scope of review and standard of review? And what do we need to know factually?
Your Honor, I think you need to know a recitation of what the medical expert opinions were as to the causation of her injuries and the duration of those injuries. And she treated for a number of years. And none of that is really addressed in the lower court's opinion. So you can't tell what the $7,000 relates to.
I may have distracted you from your line of argument. I apologize. Let's go back to the assumption that after this second trial, the trial judge concluded that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence, and he has before him now your motion for a new trial and the defendant's motion for additure. Where did he go wrong in your view?
Your Honor, first of all, as you mentioned earlier, there is basically no authority in Delaware for a defendant to move for additure. But whether the defendant moves or not, it's our position, Your Honor, that the trial judge erred when he not only agreed to award additure, but more importantly, he only sought the consent of the defendant, the moving party, to consent to the additure. The plaintiff was left out of the entire process. The plaintiff did not request additure, and the plaintiff was not asked to consent to it.
Okay. On what authority is that error?
On the authority, Your Honor, first of all, of the Dimmock Court, the United States Supreme Court in Dimmock held, of course, they actually held and they abolished the entire practice of additure in the federal system. But that arose in a setting, Your Honor, where the trial court on its own, sua sponte after trial, after the plaintiff filed a motion for a new trial, sua sponte said, well, the plaintiff is entitled to X number of dollars more, and if the defendant accepts that, that'll be the end of the case. And that's what got reversed. And the court made it clear in its ruling that the plaintiff never was a participant in that process.
Well, we're not bound by federal practice.
Certainly not.
What is the Delaware authority for your position?
The Delaware authority, again, is very slim in the sense that this almost has never happened before, that a defendant moves forward, and that the defendant, the moving party, is the party who gets to decide. That's where we believe there's a violation. It wouldn't matter to us, whether, Your Honor, whether it's the plaintiff or the defendant, but the party who moves for this type of post-trial relief, and that party is the only party that gets to decide to accept it or not, that is a violation of the non-moving party's right to jury trial. They never asked for it.
So it's state constitution-based?
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor. Okay. On Article 1, Section 4, okay, and Article 4, Section 19 of the Delaware Constitution.
If the judge is addressing whether the verdict is inadequate as a matter of law, I mean, that's a legal question, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in order to determine that zero is inadequate as a matter of law, don't you have to decide that some higher number is where the threshold is?
I don't think you have to decide an exact number, Your Honor. All you have to decide is that the number reached is not it. You're not required. I don't believe a trial judge would be required in granting a new trial to state what number might be appropriate or what even number would be minimal. All the plaintiff is asking on a motion for a new trial is that the award made, which was zero, is against the weight of the evidence. And the court would have to simply look at the evidence and look at the award, and if that is inadequate as a matter of law, that's all the court needs to rule. And, in fact, that's all the court did rule after the first trial. It did not rule after the first trial what a minimum amount or what any amount would have been reasonable. It simply ruled, following this court's precedent, a zero verdict given the medical evidence, uncontradicted and objective findings, given that evidence, zero could not stand.
Mr. Fletcher, let me just make sure I understand your position.
Yes.
It is, number one, that because the jury of the second time awarded zero damages, its verdict was against the weight of the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Number two, the remedy for that would clearly be another trial, a third trial. But in this case, the court, while awarding that, made it subsidiary to an award of attitude. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And your position is that perhaps the court shouldn't have done that at all, but even if it was allowed to do that, it certainly could not do that constitutionally without giving the plaintiff the right to veto that attitude.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the reason, you say, is that it's the plaintiff who has the right to a jury trial in these circumstances, the defendant having waived that right by moving for attitude. And it's only the plaintiff that can waive the plaintiff's right to jury trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand the argument. Is there any Delaware case that so holds?
I don't believe.
Or is this a matter of first impression?
I think this is a matter of first impression, Your Honor. I cannot cite you to a case that deals with that specifically. The most that we were able to cite to the court, and in fact was initially noted by the defendant, is an order. And I understand orders.
It is a matter of first impression.
It is a matter of first impression, yes, Your Honor.
But let me follow up on that in this sense. Let's put aside your constitutional argument about the plaintiff's right to trial by jury, and the plaintiff, it necessarily follows, would be able to veto any application for an attitude. There is some authority in the case law that speaks to the trial judge's inherent authority to manage the docket of the court. Does this fact pattern suggest that the trial judge looked at two previous trials, both of which came to zero damages, and concluded that within his inherent authority there was genuinely no point in retrying this case, and he tried to pick a number that would satisfy a reasonable verdict if it were to be retried? Now, apart from a potential constitutional bar, and I understand your argument there, is there anything to this doctrine of inherent authority to manage your docket?
Your Honor, I think that there is something to that. Certainly where we are now in the 21st century, and the court loads, it would not be fair to assume that a court cannot utilize its inherent authority to evaluate a case. My problem with that, though, Your Honor, is that it would have been an exceedingly reasonable and appropriate and lawful act had the plaintiff been included and simply been asked to consent to that additor that he did not request. All the cases we find, Your Honor, including the Carney case, which
well,
is...
Were you asked, I'm assuming you were the plaintiff.
I was, Your Honor. I actually tried the case.
Were you asked your comment on whether the additor amount was correct or any asked for an input on what would be a fair amount in additor?
Your Honor, on post-trial briefing, the plaintiff files a motion for a new trial. That's what we did. The defendant filed a motion for opposing that and a motion for additor. There was no other responses at that time. Once the court acted on those two motions, we then filed a motion for re-argument, arguing that what was done was unconstitutional, inappropriate, and we also argued in our motion for re-argument that the amount was also inappropriate, and we cited portions of the record in support of that.
All right.
And then that motion was denied.
Was it denied with any explanation?
There's a short explanation, Your Honor, yes, and it is in the appendix.
Did you want to save your time?
We asked you a lot of questions.
I apologize for that.
No, Your Honor. I would just ask the court. We certainly reserve all of our rights and arguments that we presented in our briefs as to Daisy Construction and our entitlement to present that case to a jury rather than having it decided on summary judgment. And I'll reserve the rest of my time, if I may, for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, good morning. Jeff Young on behalf of Michelle Hint. Your Honor's additor is a long-established and well-utilized tool of the trial court following a jury verdict, or in this case, jury verdicts, under certain circumstances. Let me start, actually, Chief Justice Steele, where you started, which is the amount of the additor. And in this case, as President Judge Vaughn indicated in his decision following the second trial, applying the standard noted to the evidence, one can conclude that the injuries proximately caused by the accident did not last longer than a few weeks. In terms of the post-PIP, which is what the special damages were, they were post-PIP after 2 years post-accident. Clearly, the first 10 weeks were all paid by PIP. That was not part of the boardable damages. The medical bills unpaid were for treatment long, long after that 10-week span, which President Judge Vaughn talks about in his decision. And again, consistent after listening to this for two times, the President Judge concluded that certainly at least the jury or juries could have concluded soft tissue injury, a few weeks of treatment. At the end of those few weeks, the plaintiff is saying to her doctor, I feel 80 to 90% better. The diagnostic tests are all normal. There are no objective or subjective findings for the plaintiff at that 10-week period. And end of case. After that, she falls. She has other injuries. She has other accidents. Clearly, that 10-week period was a good cutoff point for any jury, and certainly $2,500.
You're suggesting that's what we should infer from his order and from the comments that Justice Ridgely pointed out in his question?
I do, Your Honor. That's why...
You agree there's nothing specific that says that.
Well, the President Judge talks about the 10-week period following the accident. Moreover, in her own admission by the plaintiff's the plaintiff's physical state significantly improved within 10 weeks of the accident. The MRI is normal. Dr. Duchuttle's record at that point shows...
He never says specifically, I find that during the period beyond 2 years after the accident, she incurred no medical expenses caused by the accident.
He does not say that in his order. You're right, Your Honor.
Would have been easy to say that.
Yes, it would have.
Not only that, the trial judge awarded a new trial or additor.
That's correct, Your Honor, depending upon, I'm sorry.
So doesn't the fact that the trial judge ordered a second new trial subject to additor basically foreclose the factual argument that you're making here?
I'm sorry, I don't follow, Your Honor. It seems to me that the...
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're making a either a jury argument or an argument that echoes a motion for directed verdict, that there's simply no evidence of any compensable damages.
Well, I'm asking
whether that argument is not foreclosed, A, by the fact that the jury awarded zero, but B, by the fact that the judge the first time found that that verdict was against the weight of the evidence, and the second time where there were no change in circumstances, awarded a new trial again.
It remains a defense position, Your Honor, that zero is an appropriate verdict in this case. It's a soft tissue case where credibility is critical, and the plaintiff twice showed herself to be...
Well, that may be your position, but I'm asking for the basis of it, given the fact that the judge awarded two separate new trials.
Well, the judge's determination is based on the Amalfitano case. I understand that. I opposed both motions for a new trial. I lost both times. I don't think that changes the underlying case, Your Honor, and the standard to apply for a judge when determining additor is what is the reasonable minimal amount that the plaintiff can be awarded under the circumstances. And under these circumstances, the president judge decided $2,500 was ample for what could easily be determined to be a 10-week soft tissue claim.
Well, let me ask this. If, indeed, the trial judge ordered a second new or a third new trial, and in the alternative, additure, what deprives the plaintiff of the option of the new trial?
The additor, as is the case in every, barring perhaps one, every case, when there is additor, necessarily the defense has prevailed at trial. So the defense is then given the benefit of the doubt.
Wait a minute. The defense has prevailed when there's additor? There are certainly circumstances where the plaintiff wins damages, thinks the damages are inadequate, and moves for additor, and the defense hasn't prevailed.
Well, prevailed in terms of the plaintiff is unsatisfied with the verdict, the defense presumably is.
Be judged in that respect as an insurance defense lawyer would be wonderful, wouldn't it? The plaintiff wins but doesn't win enough, and I did a good job.
I think my client is here, Your Honor. I hope that it takes hold.
Well, I remember the days when I would have loved to have been judged by that standard.
In any case, Your Honor, certainly in this situation, the defense prevailed. The defense, if an additor is granted, the defense has essentially won the day at trial because the judge has determined that the evidence is greater than the number that the jury determined, whatever it is, whether it be zero or whatever the number is. And so the judge has determined, the trial judge has said, I need to add more to this case or you get a new trial. And the defense position, the defense approach then is, am I satisfied with that increased number or do I elect for another trial? To the victor go the spoils. As Judge Quillen lays out in that Carney case, really an additor is closer to holding the respect that we have for juries true. Rather than scrapping that jury altogether, the judge determines, well, they may have gotten it wrong, but they didn't get it. Rather than ignoring them altogether, we're going to add a little to what they got wrong.
But isn't it consistent with Delaware practice that if the judge chooses to opt for additor, that the plaintiff who's just been granted a new trial on his motion has the choice of the new trial or accepting the additor? Why does it suddenly become a veto by the defense? How does the defense get to veto a new trial and just pay the additor and say, all's well that ends well?
That's always the case, Your Honor. I, in every case of additor, whether the plaintiff moves, or by the way, when the court grants sua sponte, which I certainly want to address, but if the plaintiff moves,
But here's the rub. If the plaintiff moves for additure, I understand your position. Here the plaintiff did not. The plaintiff moved for a new trial because the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. The judge said, I agree. The verdict is against the weight of the evidence. The defendant then moves for additure.
Well, I don't think that's right, Your Honor.
Tell me why that's wrong, because it's been the assumption from the record.
It has been the assumption, and that's why I certainly want to address it. The defense moved for nothing in this case. The plaintiff moved for a new trial. The defense filed a response to that brief. In that response, opposing the new trial, the defense reminded the trial court that additor is a tool in its quiver, that if the court sees fit, the court can grant additor. Sua sponte. Who asks for it is really irrelevant.
Well, is it sua sponte if you mention it in your response?
I think
What does sua sponte mean?
Well, the court does it without...
How's your Latin today?
I appreciate what sua sponte means, Your Honor. But because... I don't think that this can be characterized as sua sponte. But because there are cases where courts have acted sua sponte, White v. State Farm, for instance...
Well, let me put it this way. Did you ask the court to consider additure?
Yes.
Why is that not moving for the option of additure?
Because it's not a motion. It's simply reminding the court that it's a tool. It's a tool of the trial court in a post-trial setting. The court can grant a decision notwithstanding the verdict. The court can grant summary judgment. The court can grant directed verdict. The court has tools. One of the tools is a new trial. One of the tools is an additor. And so it doesn't matter who asks for it. The defense always gets the option because for two reasons. The defense has, you may disagree with me, essentially prevailed at trial. So the standard for the additor is to give the minimum reasonable amount that the evidence supports. The other benefit to the defense is that they get to determine whether or not to accept the additor or try the case a third time in this situation.
Now, why does only the defense get to have the right to consent?
Same reason, Your Honor, that the plaintiff gets the choice in remittitor, because you get the benefit of the doubt as the prevailing party. In every remittitor case, the plaintiff gets the choice. The plaintiff has prevailed too much, so the court decides, I'm going to cut this down some, and either plaintiff, you get to accept this lower amount, or you get a new trial. It's the converse, and it works the exact same way.
So if you get a verdict in your favor but no damages, you haven't prevailed. The party against whom the verdict was rendered has prevailed because there were no damages awarded. Is that correct?
Sure.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel. The error that's complained of here is said to be of constitutional dimension, that is, the deprivation of the plaintiff's right to a jury trial, because the choice of whether or not to accept additure was afforded only to the defendant. Mr. Fletcher conceded that that's an issue of first impression in Delaware. You appear to argue otherwise. Do you have any authority that supports your position, that is, your argument that this is not a constitutional violation?
Your Honor, my time's up. May I respond? There is no authority, Your Honor. The question is, as the practice has been always, the plaintiff, the defense.
No, I'm asking about law, not practice.
There is no case law, Your Honor, no. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely. I'm Sherry Fallon, and I represent Daisy Construction. It's been more than 3 years since my client was an active participant in this case, so I will apologize in advance to the court if I don't have my hands on the record as proficiently as I did 3 years ago. In any event, Daisy Construction was a co-defendant with Michelle Hint in this case. Daisy was performing road improvements in the vicinity where this accident occurred back in November of 1999. The court granted summary judgment in favor of Daisy, and without oversimplifying that result, I would submit to the court that the decision to grant summary judgment was based upon the fact that simply because Daisy was performing construction in the vicinity of where this accident occurred did not render it liable to the plaintiff because an accident occurred where there were road improvements.
Well, isn't your position simply that the undisputed facts were that the automobile that was in front of the plaintiff, was at a stop and wasn't in any way hindered by whatever construction was going on by your client, and the plaintiff's automobile was stopped behind the first vehicle, again, without any difficulty relating to the ongoing construction. The only problem was that the defendant, whose car struck the plaintiff, was at fault and admitted that she was inattentive, and that was the only evidence of any negligence here.
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence that Daisy in any way committed any act or omission which was a proximate cause of this accident. And whether traffic was congested in that area because of the road striping that was going on by Daisy, because of a prior accident, because of traffic volume, pick any scenario, because of debris in the roadway, anything, this accident could still have occurred in the same fashion it occurred because Michelle Hint, the co-defendant, rear-ended the plaintiff, pushing the plaintiff's vehicle into the vehicle ahead of it, driven by Mr. Mayer. And the issues of fact that the plaintiff has attempted to create are really facts that have no bearing on proximate cause. As I argued to Judge Vaughn below, it's like saying the plaintiff was struck by an unlicensed driver. Well, that may be a violation of the law, but that was not a proximate cause of the accident. And even with the plaintiff's attempt to create factual issues, those factual issues aren't entirely supported by the record. For instance, in the case of Mr. Mayer, he was not even a party to the action involving the parties before you today. He had his own separate action against Mr. Young's client, Ms. Hint.
Oh, I thought your argument was going to be that if there are any fact issues, that they were not material.
They were not material to the outcome of the case, correct, Your Honor. Mr. Mayer was stopped. He saw the construction. He was stopped for several minutes, conversing with his wife, not paying attention to anything going on behind him when he was struck in the rear by the plaintiff's vehicle after it had been hit by Ms. Hint. Ms. Hint did not see any construction ahead of her. Her view was obstructed by an SUV that was behind the plaintiff's vehicle, and therefore, whether there were five flaggers there or 50 cones there, it wouldn't have made a difference in the outcome. Ms. Hint was inattentive. She was not prepared to stop in time. The SUV in front of her obstructed her view of what was happening with traffic ahead of her, and she hit the plaintiff's vehicle. And that's how the accident occurred.
I take it that the best case that could be made by the plaintiff in this case is that the construction company, had they complied with whatever national standards for setting out cones or otherwise warning traffic, might have caught her attention.
Well, that's their argument, Your Honor, that had there been a longer tapering of the cones or more than one flagger, that there may have been a more orderly process with regard to the direction of traffic, but that still does not affect the outcome. Number one, there's no evidence of that. That's speculative. Just because Ms.
You mean there's no evidence that there are a certain number of cones, so it's supposed to be a certain distance from the construction? There's no evidence of how many cones or what the distance was?
There's the evidence in the record. The only evidence in the record is that the plan adopted by Daisy to control this area was approved by DelDOT. That's undisputed. And that plan
it was consistent with the contract with DelDOT?
Consistent with the contract.
Is there any negligence per se for violation of any national standards or that apply?
There's no record of that, Your Honor. There's no expert testimony that Daisy violated or did not comply with any national standards. And there's no evidence that that the DelDOT contract, that the traffic plan that was approved by DelDOT was insufficient for this area. There's simply no evidence of that in the record. The only evidence we have is that Daisy submitted a traffic control plan that was approved by DelDOT. And the issues that the plaintiff tried to raise with that are that the plan that was approved was not the plan that was followed, but there's really no evidence of that in the record. By the plaintiff saying, I didn't see two flaggers, doesn't mean that they weren't there. By the plaintiff saying, I didn't see the barrels or cones, doesn't mean that they weren't there. In fact, she's inconsistent in that respect because in one time that her testimony was taken under oath at the arbitration in this case, she said she wasn't aware whether there were cones or barrels there, but she testified at trial that she saw the cones. Not only did she see cones, she saw road construction signs at 1,000 feet ahead, road construction 500 feet ahead. So she saw those two signs, saw the flagger directing traffic over into the left lane, saw the taper of the cones, at least that's what she said at trial, even if she didn't see it at arbitration, and safely got behind the mayor vehicle. She may have had to stop abruptly, but she didn't hit him. She stopped, and she was stopped at the time that she was struck by the Hint vehicle, who didn't see anything ahead of her because there was a car obstructing her view. So that's the point is, it doesn't matter how many cones were there, it doesn't matter how many flaggers were there, this accident would still have happened in the fashion that it happened in. And
does your argument turn on the absence of expert testimony? In other words, could there have been a factual issue if an expert had testified that by placing the flagger or the cones that this accident would not have happened?
Well, I think, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think they need the factual support for that as well. There really isn't anything in this record. We're reading, for purposes of this argument, we're viewing the record in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, but in actuality, the evidence is that there were four flaggers there. If you look at highway traffic controllers' answers to interrogatories at who was present at the scene of the accident, and they identified four flaggers, even though their sloppy bookkeeping could only produce payroll records for one. The plaintiff has latched on to that, the fact that highway traffic controllers could only produce payroll records for one flagger, and says, aha, there was only one there. But both Mr. Anderson, who's the superintendent for DAISY, testified that there was sufficient flaggers in compliance with the DLDOT plan, and the evidence produced by the interrogatory answers produced by highway traffic controllers when it was participating in the litigation indicates that they had employed four people as flaggers for the road work. So I think
but
yes.
But viewing that evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, only one payroll record, the answer is there's only one flagger.
There's only one flagger, but again, the plaintiff saw that flagger. She got over safely. Obviously, Mr. Mayer got over safely. The only one who couldn't stop in time was Ms. Hint, and as without belaboring the point, she couldn't see any number of flaggers ahead of her, whether there were one, two, or five. So she and she admitted liability. She admitted inattentiveness. And before my time is up, I just want to remind the court that we did cross appeal against highway traffic controllers. They have failed to appear before this court. Their former counsel withdrew. They have not responded to our cross appeal, so it is not opposed, and they are not here today. We had filed a third party claim against them because they were the subcontractor responsible for supplying the flaggers for the location, and should the court reopen this issue, we would want that third party complaint reopened as well. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to the defendant's presentations, I would note in the plaintiff's appendix at page 201 contains the defendant's response in opposition to our motion for a new trial. And in paragraph 3, the defendant specifically requests the court to award a minimal additor. And that's the request that the court acted on when it granted additor. Regarding the claim against DAISY Construction, the rendition of the facts, I believe, illustrate that there are disputes as to responsibility for this accident. While the driver ahead of Ms. Reed states that he slowed down for construction equipment moving across the road, Ms. Reed testified that that slowing down was sudden and she had a slam on her brakes and missed that vehicle by this much in bringing her vehicle to a stop. Ms. Hint was not the next vehicle behind Ms. Reed. There was an SUV behind Ms. Reed, according to Ms. Hint, and that SUV went off of the road, went into the median to avoid hitting the Reed vehicle. And Ms. Hint said, I had a split second. Do I go off the road? Do I go straight ahead and stop? She decided to go straight ahead, stop. But before she stopped, she rear-ended Ms. Reed. Also, the driver ahead stated that there were cars or vehicles flying everywhere. That was his description of what occurred here. There were the impact between the Hint and Reed vehicle propelled the Reed vehicle into the vehicle ahead of her. It also caused the Reed vehicle to turn around 180 degrees, and then it was struck a second time by the Hint vehicle.
What were your specific allegations of negligence on the part of the highway traffic controllers in DAISY?
Your Honor, it really boils down to two issues, flaggers and cones. The flagger issue is that their supervisor, Larry Anderson, testified that this work site needed two flaggers, one with the painting equipment that was slowly moving down the road, and a second flagger at the Woodside U.S. 13 intersection. Now, it also states in there that when you have more than one flagger, those flaggers are required to keep in constant communication with one another. What happened was equipment was being moved off of the lane that was closed down, was being moved off, but they had to stop traffic in the open lane to do that. Since that flagger wasn't there with the equipment, Your Honor, he didn't communicate to the flagger at Woodside. The flagger at Woodside continued to allow vehicles to funnel down the road, and then everyone all of a sudden had to suddenly stop without warning. The cone issue, Your Honor, very quickly, it was supposed to be cone 600 feet south of Woodside. Ms. Reed testified there were no cones south of the Woodside intersection, which would have allowed traffic to farther back to move into a single lane, and they would have been in a single lane at Woodside, and the flagger could have stopped them so that no more vehicles would go down the road while the equipment was being moved, and that never happened.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.